Hello again from Holden Village. Today is June 16th, 1998. And this evening, the presenter is Paul Olson, and his session will be Sports and Literature, Where Are We Going with Sports in America? This is tape number OLP-98-5. And now let's go listen to Paul as he conducts the lecture and discussion.
This is a literature session on sports and literature. Where is America going and what can we learn from the writers? And my name is Paul Olson. I'm going to ask you a question right after I make a statement about what I do for a living. I have the unusual privilege of teaching literature at a wonderful college, and also being the head track and cross-country coach. So I get to coach and be with kids through 4 years of their life, and I get to teach great books, and those crazy administrators pay me to do it. And my statement to start off tonight would be that I believe I have learned more about coaching and about the nature of sports from literature than I have learned from all the books I've read on physiology and biomechanics and how, what it is to be a track athlete and how you coach kids that way. And that's kind of the connection that I'm going to try to establish tonight and have you guys help me. But most of our help will come from some great poets and novelists and autobiographies and in world literature. If you came to hear poems and excerpts of literature that are specifically and directly about sports, you will be partially fulfilled. But I think that sports, well, I'll back up. We hear an argument among administrators and boards and so on that it's good that you go out for sports because you'll learn about life. And that's true, but I would contend that we do far more than learn about life. We participate in life. We participate in life in an intense way that comes maybe only through those kinds of things that we give ourselves so emotionally to, like music, like drama, like sports, like lots of the co-curricular activities that kids engage in. You know, either as parents or as yourself or as grandparents, that kids really invest a lot of themselves emotionally and, if you will, spiritually into those co-curricular activities. Sometimes, and I say this as an experienced English teacher, way more than they give themselves emotionally and spiritually and even intellectually to the pursuit of their career, you know, what they're going to major in. And there I'm talking about college kids, of course. Well, lots of literature throughout the world, including the Bible, as everybody knows, you know, run the good race, and Paul's statement about racing, the who gets the prize, and so on. Lots of literature has direct, specific allusions or applications to sports. Allusions, I mean, just a reference to it. But I think more important and even better and more true to life and more true to what sports are really all about, either what they are about or what they should be about, and that's what we'll have some fun with tonight, I hope. Literature has an indirect and a kind of thematic connection to what happens to those of us who participate in sports. I'll illustrate that specifically, but I'm going to have you help me. I'll list the things on the board a little bit first. List some things that are good about sports and that kids or that adults too, lots of us still on these things, that we experience when we participate in sports. And I'll get you started. I'm going to have two columns, the good stuff and the bad stuff. And one of the good things that happens in sports, I would contend, is that kids experience intensity. And that's a good thing. Intensity a lot more than sitting and playing at the computer or sitting and watching television. There's a different kind of, because there's emotional and physical, just fatigue involved. And the intensity is a good thing. Another good thing, I think, is that kids show, or athletes, I should say, they show courage. They have, or they take upon themselves, and these overlap, I think, they're willing to take risks. Not everybody is, and you have no choice. If you're a piano player and you're going to do your recital, you're going to take a risk, and that is you're going to go out there in front of your mom and your dad and your grandma and your grandpa and your aunt and your uncle and your nephew, you know, just your relative, most of those things. Okay, you're going to go in front of all the people that are there, and you could fail. And you take a great risk. And the actor that goes out, you know, can she forget her lines? Well, yeah, she can. And an athlete can fail. We saw Michael Jordan do it in game two, or game one, I guess it was. You can fall down. You're the king, and all of a sudden, you're going in for the last shot, and you fall. We take risks. I would say that in sports, some of the good things that can happen is that athletes can learn to show love. And that always sounds kind of hokey, you know, and especially in sports, and we're getting away from it, and I think the growth of women's sports has helped that, but also the growth of conscious coaches has helped it too. But way back when the Packers won the first Super Bowl, and they were asked, what do you attribute your success to? Anybody remember that? I'll never forget it. We love each other. Yeah. And here's these guys all full of mud, they're giants, and we love each other. And everybody's like, whoa, they entered kind of a new territory, at least articulated. It wasn't new in their experience, but they didn't talk about it much. And I think also some good things that happen, and I'll try to demonstrate this, is that athletes demonstrate faith. Concretely, to demonstrate faith, I think, means that I coach track, so I use the examples there. Here's the kid that's been kind of had a sore ankle all week and hasn't been on the track one day. And now, but he says, my ankle feels good, I'm ready to race. Can I race, coach? It's up to you. And you go, okay, yeah, I'm okay. Well, he's not going on. He didn't have that Wednesday workout where he did 10 400s at 62 seconds and can prove to him, oh, I'm ready to go. He has nothing to go on. And he's got to go on something else. And practicing faith, I think, in any dimension of our life is a helpful thing, because faith, just practicing it, living on faith, is a difficult thing. Most of us like certainty. I want to go, I had a good workout Wednesday, I know I'm ready. Or I had a good practice on Thursday, I know I'm ready. I'm doing a play tomorrow night by myself, and I rehearsed today, and the rehearsal went great, and now I'm setting myself up. Now I'm ready. And I have also gone for a couple of weeks without ever rehearsing. Somehow a show comes up and I just have to do it. I don't have a rehearsal to help me. I usually screw up then too. Okay, listen, you guys, what else can you do? What else can we see that's good, or that can be good in sports?
Discipline,
great. Don't we know it?
Interaction and team play.
Yeah, team play. Not me first. And I read an article about Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen in the game number 5, which they lost, and the sports writer, I don't have a lot of confidence in sports writers, very few of them, at least in our area, have ever played in their life. But they were knocking Jordan and Pippen for becoming selfish, and that's why they lost the game. And then Kukoc was scoring about 40 points, and they didn't pass him the ball. They forgot this team interaction. Other things that are good.
I think there's something that has to do with dealing with diversity, with multicultural diversity, or diversity of talent.
There's all kinds of diversity, and you said that. Talent, I'm going to write it down. Cultural, and et cetera. In all kinds of teams, not every team, not the team I grew up in northern Minnesota, we were all white, little, you know, Norwegians. But boy, in college, we have black kids, we have foreign kids, we have kids that are great national champions, and we have kids that run slower than I do. And that's bad, believe me. But they're out there, and they learn to respect. You're right, it's a great thing. Anything else? Good.
Learn from failure?
Yes. Failure.
And success.
Yeah, great point, yep. Oh, I just won the national championship. I guess I'm king, huh? Sorry. Get tomorrow. It's gone. Good. One of my favorite stories in my own life as a coach about taking risks is a few years ago we had a great team in cross country, and we thought we could be national champions, and that was our goal all year long. So for months, we were building toward we're going to be the national champions. And they're running great, and they're setting school records and meet records and all kinds of things. And we got to the national meet, and that terrible college up in Northfield, Minnesota, Carleton, beat us in the national meet out in New York by 3 points, and we got second. And two of our kids had tears in their seniors. Had tears in her eyes, and everybody else was just kind of moping around. We got together in our team, after every race we had a team huddle, we got together in the team race afterwards, and I saw all these sad faces, and I said, well, I guess next year we'll go for 10th, and then we'll be happy when we're second. And he looked at me and said, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. And my point is that they were willing to take a risk, and as soon as they realized that that was part of what they were about, it was a good thing, and they were a little more satisfied the second they think that. Well, let's move fast and get this literature and hear what people that think better than I do say about sports. What can be bad? So if you're a parent, you know. If you're a kid, you know. I mean,
the winning is everything?
Yeah.
What you were just talking about?
I'll just put winning, exclamation point. Winning is everything. Who made that statement famous?
Lombardi.
And has everybody heard that? Lombardi said, winning isn't the most important thing, winning is the only thing. But we got to correct that. He gets a bad rap for it, because here's the context of that. He was criticizing his athletes who were asking for more money, and he said it this way. To them, winning isn't the most important thing, winning is everything. But there's a big difference, isn't it? So anyway, we'll clarify. redeem Lombardi's reputation. What else?
Is competitiveness good or bad?
We got to put it both sides, don't we?
Yeah.
Competition and competitiveness. Yep, we know how it can be bad, and we also know how it can be good. Good.
Injuries.
And they can be serious.
I'm not feeling used.
Exploitation. And I heard obnoxious parents. I think that's why I stay on the college level. I never have that. I mean, obnoxious parents, they all are just, I don't know.
Poor sportsmanship.
Sure, poor sportsmanship. Let's be specific about that. I mean, what kind of things are manifest? I mean, how is it manifest?
Egos,
and that goes along here with learn to handle failure, success, poor sportsmanship. What do we see? We see a Dennis Rodman kick a camera in. We see brutality. We see for some football players. I once had a colleague. I played football in college, and so I have, I guess, strong feelings and great experiences there. A colleague in our literature department at Augustana was talking about two kids colliding out there. He said, where else do we teach people to just maul each other? And my comeback was, and where else do we teach them to stop when a whistle blows? It's good and bad. And I mean, the kids that can't stop when the whistle blows, they're the ones that are the poor sport. The job of the game, and we got helmets and pads and stuff, okay. So poor sportsmanship, good. What else?
Cheap shots.
Mm-hmm. And that sure ties in. My writing is getting bad. Never started out very good. Starts out with winning at any cost. We'll take the cheap shot.
Cheating.
And we cheat. I once heard, this is mind-boggling to me. I heard some high school kids who were freshmen at Augustana complaining about some kids from another high school that, oh, they always used to take shortcuts. I said, what? You take a shortcut in cross country. It doesn't even make any sense. What are you doing out there? You're running this race, see how fast you can run it, and you haven't done it if you've taken a shortcut. Well, cheating, but if you got to win, take a shortcut.
I think it can be exclusionary. It can become of an institution or a culture that if you're not part of it or you can't be part of it, you feel very shut out.
Exclusive, and I like your word better, even exclusionary. Yes, good. Something that some of the literature touches on that we want to mention is that, because I've got quite a bit actually, is, and I'll put it both places, our heroes. And the notion of hero worship. And who are our heroes? I think of some of the guys that you know, that kids, or that Americans, I call them kids so much, and that's really probably not fair, that Americans create as their heroes, that when you think about it, come on, really a hero? But think of something like that. I'm a Packer fan, and Brett Favre, you know, but a hero? But he is. If I had a son young enough to tell him what to do, I don't anymore. I'm not sure I ever did. And they said, Brett Favre is my hero. I think I would say, well, why don't you try Huckleberry Finn? I mean, it's fictitious, but there are more heroic things about Huck Finn than there are probably about Brett Favre. And I love Brett Favre, and I think he's a tremendous quarterback, but he's not my hero.
Maybe another word for hero would be role model.
Sure.
That needs to come up there when you're thinking sports.
Yep, it's a great point. And that goes, doesn't it, both ways too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The role models can be good or they can be bad. Well, have we covered everything? Anybody else?
Drugs. Thinking, you know, along the lines of steroids and those kinds of things.
You maybe read this. It's popular among track coaches, this piece of knowledge. When the United States hosted the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles, somebody went to all of the athletes in lots of different sports, not every single athlete, but they took a whole bunch in different sports and said this to them. If you knew that this drug could get you a medal, but might kill you 6 or 10 years down the road, would you take it? Guess what they said?
Yes.
All of them said that.
Winning's everything.
Yeah. And whether they just didn't dawn on them, it's hard to even contemplate what they were thinking. But winning is everything. Yeah. Anything else? Well,
how about short-sightedness, you know, when they think of their future and so on? I think sometimes it becomes more important than life, like you were saying.
And after what he just said, that definitely.
Yeah. Here's, I'm ready, we can't read it anyway. Short-sightedness and living for this moment and without any plans for the future. At our stand, we have a great high jumper. He was national champion indoors, and he's gone 7-3, and that's high as the ceiling almost. And he had a bad knee, and he wanted to jump in the outdoor national meet, and I had to talk him out of it. You're talking your career. You're talking, you know, when you're 45 years old, not being able to play basketball, and you like to do that stuff. Don't jump. and he's a brilliant, straight-A student, biology, pre-med, maintenance. But short-sightedness isn't only intellectual. It's emotional. Well, coach, I want to compete. I'm ready to go. And somebody has to be around to help that emotional kid think and not be so short-sighted. It's a great point. I mean, good kids do it.
Not all coaches.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. A lot of coaches. I mean, you go for it, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah.
Under your inclusionary, it can be both physical and gender.
For sure.
The WNBA is a great thing.
Yeah. And the gender one is being addressed in most places quite well, but not every place. I mean, the facilities surely aren't equal at most schools. We're having a lawsuit in Rock Island High School right now with women's facilities versus men's. Part-time coaches for women's sports and full-time coaches for men's sports. But we're getting there. I mean, that doesn't mean we're there, but it's happening and people are conscious. But it's a great point. Other things. Well, we listed some good things here, and so these are the themes I'm going to call. These are the themes of sports. And how does literature address these kinds of things in our lives? And what can it say to us that we then can apply to these parts of our lives? So some of the things I read aren't even about sports at all. But you will make the connection. And that's why I started this whole session by saying, I learned more about coaching from literature than I did from any textbook about coaching, and I've got a bookshelf full of them, and I've read them, I pay attention to them, and they haven't taught me half as much as stuff like this has. And let's just go with that. And the first thing to go with is a poem. I'm going to do an advertising one right now, too. Tomorrow night, after chapel, there's a solo dramatic performance of poetry that I do. And it's over in the VC, and it's going to be at like 8:30 or something like that.
Don't miss it. I've heard it many times.
That's my that's my mother. my surrogate mother. She's not old enough to be my mother.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you are.
Grandma.
But my, okay. And this is one of the poems in that show, but it makes a point about a lot of things it says about literature, and it says some things about sports, and it says some of the things that we've said already. What it says about literature is, if we really experience the thing that we're reading, be it fiction or autobiography, whatever it is, in this case not poetry, if we really experience that, something happens to us that wasn't there before. And or it can talk about that experience. This poem is about, really about, someone who loves the athlete. You'll get it. Do you remember how you won that last race? How you flung your body at the start? How your spikes ripped the cinders in the stretch? How you catapulted through the tape? Do you remember? Don't you think I lurched with you out of those starting holes? Anybody here a parent of an athlete? Or if you're an athlete, and just think about when your mom and dad are watching, or your sister's watching, they're like this every time. My first year of coaching, I came home from a meet, and when I was in college, I ran three races every meet. I ran the 400, that's a hard race. I came back and ran the 200, and I came back and ran the 400, and the mile relay again. Every time we had a meet, I'd come home and go out dancing and go drink Pepsi, and that's what it was, too. That was no problem. I started coaching, I'd come home from a meet, and just a year later, I'd collapse. You know why? Every jump, you know, here's six kids long jumping, and they each get six jumps. 36 times, I'm like this. And then I got to run the mile for six kids, and I got to run the 400 to get the point. Well, this is about that, too. Don't you think I lurched with you out of those starting holes? Don't you think my sinews tightened at those first few strides? And as you flew into the stretch, was not all my thrill of 1,000 races in your blood? At your final drive through the finish line, did not my shout tell of the triumphant ecstasy of victory? There's more to the poem, but that's enough. What's happened over here? What have you just seen?
Intensity.
Great.
Risk.
Takes a risk.
Can you do it?
Love?
Yeah.
Don't you think my sinews tightened? Our younger son plays hockey, or did, and he was good every Tuesday night. I mean, we talked to my wife and I, she's right there, we talked about Tuesday night, get to see Eric play hockey. And she, every time he gets slammed, you know, that pretty rough game, he gets, oh! That's it. Way to go, Eric. Love is created. What else? Just in that poem.
Highs and lows.
Highs and lows. Mm-hmm. Boy, that's sports all the way. And it seems courage. To me, it's life too, isn't it? Highs and lows. Yeah.
Courage.
Courage. Your sinews tighten. Well, here's the ending of that poem. Live as I've taught you to run. It's a short dash. Dig your starting holes firm and deep. Lurch out of them with all the power that's in you. Run straight, run high, run hard, save nothing. That's the end of it. And the final, the last line. And finish with an ecstatic burst. take risks, be courageous. Good. Well, let's listen to what some of these great writers have to say. Maya Angelou, everybody knows her. She read Clinton's, wrote a poem, you know. And I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Had a paper, had a mark in here. Maya Angelou is black, and this autobiography is her first one of her youth days in the South growing up. And everybody's gathered around the radio to hear the Joe Louis and the big fight. And he, of course, he's white, and Joe Louis is black. And it's a Joe Louis is carrying the black population on his shoulders. And she's a beautiful writer, as you'll be able to tell. The last inch of space was filled, yet people continued to wedge themselves along the walls of the store. Her grandmother owned the store and had the radio, and that's where everybody came. Uncle Willie had turned the radio up to its last knot so that youngsters on the porch wouldn't miss a word. Women sat on kitchen chairs, dining room chairs, stools, and upturned wooden boxes. Small children and babies perched on every lap available, and men leaned on the shelves or on each other. The apprehensive mood was shot through with shafts of gaiety as a black sky is streaked with lightning. I ain't worried about this fight. Joe's gonna whip that cracker like it's open season. He gonna whip him till that white boy call him mama. At last, the talking was finished and the string-along songs about razor blades are over and a fight began. A quick jab to the head. In the store, the crowd grunted. A left to the head and a right and another left. One of the listeners cackled like a hen and was quieted. They're in a clinch. Lewis is trying to fight his way out. Some bitter comedian on the porch said, that white man don't mind hugging that nigga now, I bet you. The referee is moving in to break them up, but Lewis finally pushed the contender away, and it's an uppercut to the chin. The contender is hanging on. Now he's backing away. Lewis catches him with a short left to the jaw. A tide of the murmuring assent poured out the doors and into the yard. Another left, then another left. Lewis is saving that mighty right. The mutter in the store had grown into a baby roar, and it was pierced by the clang of a bell and the announcers. That's the bell for round three, ladies and gentlemen. As I pushed my way into the store, I wondered if the announcer gave any thought to the fact that he was addressing as ladies and gentlemen all the Negroes around the world who sat sweating and praying, glued to their master's voice. That's an allusion to, what were black women called?
Mama.
Mama, auntie. And what were black grandpas called? Boy. Ladies and gentlemen, never. One of the things in an earlier autobiography, she's disgusted with it. Nobody calls her grandmother Mrs. Johnson. So that's what that alluded to. There were only a few calls for RC Colas, Dr. Peppers, and Hires Root Beer. Remember, they're in a store. The real festivities would begin after the fight. Then even the old Christian ladies who taught their children and tried themselves to practice turning the other cheek would buy soft drinks. And if Brown Bomber's victory was a particularly bloody one, they would order peanut butter patties and Baby Ruth's, too. Bailey, that's her brother. Bailey and I lay the coins on top of the cash register. Uncle Willie didn't allow us to ring up sales during a fight. It was too noisy and might shake up the atmosphere. When the gong rang for the next round, we pushed through the near sacred quiet to the herd of children outside. He's got Lewis against the rope, and now it's a left to the body and a right to the ribs, another right to the body. It looks like it was low. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the referee is signaling, but the contender keeps raining the blows on Lewis. It's another to the body, and it looks like Lewis is going down. My race groaned. It was our people falling. It was another lynching. Yet another black man hanging on a tree. One more woman ambushed and raped. A black boy whipped and maimed. It was hounds on the trail of a man running through slimy swamps. It was a white woman slapping her maid for being forgetful. The men in the store stood away from the walls and at attention. Women greedily clutched the babes on their laps while on the porch the shufflings and smiles, flirtings and pitching of a few minutes before were gone. This might be the end of the world. If Joel lost, we were back in slavery and beyond help. It would all be true, the accusations that we were lower types of human beings, only a little higher than the apes. True that we were stupid and ugly and lazy and dirty and unlucky, and worst of all, that God himself hated us and ordained us to be hewers of wood and drawers of water forever and ever, world without end. We didn't breathe. We didn't hope. We waited. He's off the ropes, ladies and gentlemen. He's moving towards the center of the ring. There was no time to be relieved. The worst might still happen. And now it looks like Joe is mad. He's caught Camera with a left hook, Carnera. He's caught Carnera with a left hook to the head and a right to the head. It's a left jab to the body and another left to the head. There's a left cross and a right to the head. The contender's right eye is bleeding and he can't seem to keep his block up. Lewis is penetrating every block. The referee is moving in, but Lewis sends a left to the body and it's the uppercut to the chin and the contender is dropping. He's on the canvas, ladies and gentlemen. Love the sentence. Baby slid to the floor. As women stood up and men leaned toward the radio. Here's the referee. He's counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Is the contender trying to get up? All the men in the store shouted, no! 8, 9, 10. There were a few sounds from the audience, but they seemed to be holding themselves in against tremendous pressure. The fight is all over, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get the microphones over to the referee. Here he is. He's got the brown bomber's hand. He's holding it up. Here he is. Then the voice, husky and familiar, came to wash over us. The winner and still heavyweight champion of the world, Joe Louis. Champion of the world, a black boy, some black mother's son. He was the strongest man in the world. People drank Coca-Colas like ambrosia and ate candy bars like Christmas. Some of the men went behind the store and poured white lightning in their soft drink bottles. And a few of the bigger boys followed them. Those who were not chased away came back blowing their breath in front of themselves like proud smokers. It would take an hour or more before the people would leave the store and head for home. Those who lived too far had made arrangements to stay in town. It wouldn't do for a black man and his family to be caught on a lonely country road on a night when Joe Louis had proved that we were the strongest people in the world. It's a great story. What do you find here in the experience of life that is an experience of sport?
I think for a lot of us, we cannot comprehend what slavery and their experience was. After hearing that and the way she wrote it, we get a glimpse and experience maybe what they actually went through. Don't go home country on a road country night. Just the language and the lingo. We experience part of what it was to be a black in the South in that time period.
Yep, great.
That was cool. Let's see that book again. That's kind of cool.
It's in the library. I mean, it's in the bookstore. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
Okay.
And, you know, if you're unfamiliar with African-American literature, this is a great place to start. I mean, it's a wonderful story, and I think another great place to start with African-American literature is Richard Wright's Black Boy.
That's good.
Anything else that we see happening here? This is life, and it's sports.
Togetherness and team interaction.
Yeah,
Even though it's not a team.
Team among the fans, isn't it? And great.
Big-time role model.
Big-time role model. We're the strongest people in the world.
What I thought of was being Joe Louis and how much pressure's on his shoulders. I mean, he has his entire race.
Yep.
You know, all he has is his physical strength and, you know, his aggressiveness and everything, but still, I mean, that's just tremendous pressure.
Yep.
The diversity.
And how many of our athletes today think that way? No, they think of themselves. And, you know, athletes are, you know, dime a dozen. That particular time, you know, I think that's the difference.
And you could pay attention to the media, and not just in sports, and how they approach the first black anchor woman. How does it feel to be, oh wait a minute, I'm not representing the black, or the first black senator, or you name it. You had a...
Oh, I'm just an aside, I don't know, probably not too many people here listen to that fight because they're not old enough, but... you know, Carnera outweighed Louis about 50 pounds. He was the largest man that Louis ever fought.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. He was Italian. He was a giant, about 6 foot five. Louis weighed
Did
about...
Did you listen to the fight?
Oh, yes. I listened to every Joe Louis fight.
So did I.
Yeah, he was an Italian and a giant, like 6 foot four or five, weighed like 250 pounds, and Louis was about 210. It was, you know, so it was Louis against the giant.
Okay, this chapter is 4 pages long. Your assignment is to do that. Yeah.
Winning is terribly important. You know, he wins, we win.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or if he loses, we lose.
We lose, right. And is it different because it's a African-American community, though? I mean, do white people feel that? We don't put the weight of the white race on Brett Favre.
But did you feel that in the race?
That
if the white guy lost, you lost?
Ooh, no.
I mean, did you guys feel that?
Or was the whole state of Wisconsin loses if the Packers lose.
So it was from Illinois, too.
But the fact that Joe Louis was the champion made you want him to be the champion. And I remember the radio being on the street. It turned up as loud as it could be, and all the people outside, because everybody didn't have radios.
Yeah.
And so there was kind of a group feeling there, too.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah, and it was important for an American to win, too.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Max Schmeling, the German, and the Italian, and I mean, it was...
We really wanted him to win.
But does she talk about any of his other fights? Is that
no.
I was going to say, because that fight didn't have anywhere near the intensity as the second Max Schmeling fight.
Well, Max Schmeling, yeah.
That was the
and
one
then,
that
what, the last one was Ezra Charles. Did I find
I
you?
Think so.
He was American.
Well, and Schmeling knocked him out, and then in the first round, he gets rid of Schmeling in the rematch. Wasn't it the first?
Well, Schmeling knocked Lewis out the first fight, then Lewis knocked Schmeling out the first
We're
fight.
Losing the point here.
Yeah, no, well, what you're doing is great. It just this is what sports is in our culture. And we are there, and the whole community comes to Maya Angelou's grocery store, and they listen to this thing, and we're seeing how sports has captured us, and we see also how, and this is all the things that you listed, how all of this good stuff, because it's so much a part of us, can become evil too. And here's the way it can be. This poem has nothing to do with sports, but it's a wonderful one by one of my favorite poets, Wendell Berry. It has nothing to do with sports, but it has everything to do with sports. The line I've set up for you is, this isn't nearly as long as the excerpt I just read from Maya Angelou. The line I want to set you up for is that, who has imagined that your death could be negligible to me now that I've seen these pictures of your face? And what I'm going to connect here with sports is, this is Wendell Berry, who has just spent the day looking through a photography book of pictures of Russian peasants. And he writes this poem after he's done call to a Siberian woodsman after looking at some pictures in a magazine. And my point in connecting it here is, this is the enemy. And I'm from Minnesota, and you guys from Packerland are the enemy. And how far do you take that? And you know, there are conferences in every athletic jurisdiction in America. We have this conference and that conference, and we have rivals, and we know what it is. And you know, and Wartburg and Luther hate each other, right? And St. Olaf and Carleton hate each other, and Augsburg and Gustavus Adolphus hate each other. And nobody hates Augustana. everybody hates Augustana. They hate winners. Well, this is to be a Siberian woodsman. And think about it in connection with the enemy. Or my own language for our kids is, these guys are not your enemies, they're your rivals. But rivals are over here, like the word competition, we put it on both sides of the ledger, right? Okay. You lean at ease in your warm house at night after supper, listening to your daughter play the accordion. You smile with the pleasure of a man confident in his hands, resting after a day of long labor in the forest. The cry of the saw in your head, and the vision of coming home to rest. This is the poet imagining the Siberian woodsman. Your daughter's face is clear in the joy of hearing her own music. Her fingers live on the keys like people familiar with the land they were born in. You, Siberian woodsman, sit at the dinner table late into the night with your son, tying the bright flies that will lead you along the forest streams. Over you, as your hands work, is the dream of the still pools. Over you is the dream of your silence while the east brightens, birds waking close by you in the trees. I have thought of you stepping out of your doorway at dawn. I'll stop for a second. Packer fans, can you imagine a Viking fan stepping out of his doorway? I just want to kill him, right? I have thought of you stepping out of your doorway at dawn, your son in your tracks. You go in under the overarching green branches of the forest whose ways, strange to me, are well known to you as the sound of your own voice, or the silence that lies around you now that you have ceased to speak. And soon the voice of the stream rises ahead of you and you take the path beside it. I have thought of the sun breaking pale through the mists over you as you come to the pool where you will fish, and of the mist drifting over the water and of the cast fly resting light on the face of the pool. And I am here in Kentucky, in the place I have made myself in the world. I sit on my porch above the river that flows muddy and slow along the feet of the trees. I hear the voices of the wren and the yellow-throated warbler whose songs pass near the windows and over the roof. In my house, my daughter learns the womanhood of her mother. My son is at play, pretending to be the man he believes I am. I am the outbreathing of this ground. My words are its words, and as the wren's song is its song. Who has invented our enmity? Who has prescribed us hatred of each other? Who has armed us against each other with the death of the world? Who has appointed me such anger that I should desire the burning of your house or the destruction of your children? Who has appointed such anger to you? Who has set loose the thought that we should oppose each other with the ruin of forests and rivers and the silence of birds? They're talking about atomic warfare. But when we talk about sports, we think, hey, Michael Jordan's got a sprained ankle. Maybe we can beat him. Who has said to us that the voices of my land shall be strange to you and the voices of your land strange to me? Who has imagined that I would destroy myself in order to destroy you, or that I could improve myself by destroying you? Who has imagined that your death could be negligible to me now that I have seen these pictures of your face? Who has imagined that I would not speak familiarly with you, or laugh with you, or visit in your house and go to work with you in the forest? And now one of the ideas of my place will be that you would gladly talk and visit and work with me. I sit in the shade of the trees of the land I was born in. As they are native, I am native, and I hold to this place as carefully as they hold to it. I do not see the national flag flying from the staff of the sycamore. You get that line? About nationalism and patriotism and the Green Bay Packer flag, I do not see the national flag flying from the staff of the sycamore or any decree of the government written on the leaves of the walnut. Nor has the elm bowed before the monuments or sworn the oath of allegiance. They have not declared to whom they stand in welcome. In the thought of you, I imagine myself free of the weapons and the official hates that I have borne on my back like a hump. And in the thought of myself, I imagine you free of weapons and official hates, so that if we should meet, we would not go by each other looking at the ground like slaves sullen under their burdens, but would stand clear in the gaze of each other. There is no government so worthy as your son who fishes with you in silence beside the forest pool. There is no national glory so comely as your daughter whose hands have learned the music and go their own way on the keys. There is no national glory so comely as my daughter who dances and sings and is the brightness of my house. And there is no government so worthy as my son who laughs as he comes up the path from the river in the evening for joy.
Good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Wendell Berry, he's in the library. He's also over in the bookstore too. Well, another dimension that everybody gets a sense of that and how it connects. I mean, sports is life. It's not all of life, but it's not about life, it is. And we participate in all of those feelings that he does about war and about enmity. We could say that, and we could have our athletes say that. How can anyone imagine your defeat, you know, negligible, now that I've seen pictures of your face? Defeat is okay, maybe. Well, we've got some heroes too, and we talked about how we pick our heroes. And anybody, just can we lift up just for a second a strange hero, somebody that's idolized or is a role model that you really would rather your kids didn't role model after?
Michael Jackson.
I don't know. It's okay. I mean, we're not going to debate them. Just throw them out, and some will say yes, and some will say no.
Dennis Rodman.
Yeah. Who's the guy that always got in the fights, basketball player? Not Rodman, but fights off.
Sproul?
Yeah.
And who else? Just Settles.
Yeah, and Settles too.
Yeah.
They're our role models. And what are those role models? You know, we all watch the it seems as though the most important thing in our lives is money. I remember being a little kid, a young adult, I guess, thinking of the years where this was, when the great quarterback from the Minnesota Vikings, Joe, went on to politics.
Cap.
Quit because he wasn't going to get enough money. Now, maybe his agent put it up to him, but here he is at the prime of his life, but also at the end of his career. He's maybe got 2 or 3 years left, and he holds out for more money. And I coach 100 kids every day who would give $1,000 to be able to play. I don't want my own children role modeling after that guy who's willing to give up a career because money is so important. And to give up the ability to play this game. And they go out there and have fun playing. Our entertainment, yeah, but they have fun, and they, but I gotta have a couple million more, or I'm not gonna play at all. You know, remember when we were kids, take your ball and go home? It's kind of that. Well, there are other heroes out there, but we miss them sometimes. Here's just a paragraph, or two paragraphs, out of the autobiography of Malcolm X, that much maligned leader, and you'll see why, and he's aware of that. Anyway, now each day I live as if I'm already dead, and I tell you what I would like for you to do. When I am dead, I say it that way because from the things I know, I do not expect to live long enough to read this book in its finished form. He knew America. I want you to just watch and see if I'm not right in what I say, that the white man in his press is going to identify me with hate. Read this book. Malcolm X cannot be identified with hate. He will make use of me dead as he has made use of me alive as a convenient symbol of hatred. And that will help him to escape facing the truth that all I have been doing is holding up a mirror to reflect, to show the history of unspeakable crimes that his race has committed against my race. You watch. I will be labeled as, at best, an irresponsible black man. I have always felt about this accusation that the black leader, whom white men consider to be responsible, is invariably the black leader who never gets any results. You only get action as a black man if you are regarded by the white man as irresponsible. And I don't want to push this, but that's Jesus' role too. I mean, he's irresponsible. If he hadn't done anything and just played along with the system, he'd have been fine. In fact, this much I learned when I was just a little boy. And since I have been some kind of a leader, he puts it in quotes, of black people here in the racist society of America, I have been more reassured each time the white man resisted me or attacked me harder, because each time made me more certain that I was on the right track in the American black man's best interests. The racist white man's opposition automatically made me know that I did offer the black man something worthwhile. Yes, I have cherished my demagogue role. I know that societies often have killed the people who have helped to change those societies. We can just rattle them off, the great leaders. And if I can die having brought any light, having exposed any meaningful truth that will help to destroy the racist cancer that is malignant in the body of America, then all of the credit is due to God. Only the mistakes have been mine. I just read it to let you think about the notion of role models and of who we follow and what kinds of principles they live and speak about. You have up there Taking Risks. Here's a very short poem by Nikki Giovanni. No, it's not here. It's by Langston Hughes. Frederick Douglass, the slave, the slave that escaped and wrote narratives and was a great abolitionist, did lots of speaking. And Douglass was someone who, had he walked with wary foot and frightened tread, you guys talked earlier about the piano recitalist and the athlete going out there to take the risk. Douglass, who was someone who, had he walked with wary foot and frightened tread, from very indecision, might be dead, might have lost his soul, but instead decided to be bold and capture every street on which he set his feet to route each path toward freedom's goal, to make each highway choose his compass's choice. To all the world cried, "Hear my voice, oh, to be a beast, a bird, anything but a slave," he said. "Who would be free themselves must strike the first blow," he said. He died in 1895. He is not dead. Well, I'm suggesting it has nothing to do with sports, but it does, doesn't it? It has, and the way you've defined what goes on in this sports experience, it has everything to do with sports and who we idolize, who we model after, and how we decide to live our lives. I'll skip some. Here. This is famous enough that I don't have to introduce it. This is a, I'll let you see if you can figure it out. This is a 19th century speaker. No more clues. Well, children, where there is so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think twixt the Negroes of the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights, the white men will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this here talking about? That man over there says women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me the best place, and ain't I a woman? Look at me, look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen them most all sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? Then they talk about this thing in the head. What's this that they call it? Intellect, someone whispers to her. That's it, honey. What's that got to do with women's rights or Negro rights? If my cup won't hold but a pint and yours holds a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Then that little man in black there, he says women can't have as much rights as men because Christ wasn't a woman. Where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with it. If the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, these women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. And now they are asking to do it the men better led. You ever heard of that? Sojourner Truth, the famous abolitionist and slave, ex-slave. We're talking about role models and what we stand for, and our sports culture takes over with maybe some misguided representations for the roles that we see. Here's another book. It's in the library. I don't think it's in the bookstore. I went to South Africa the year right after Nelson Mandela was freed, and I've long been a student, or at least interested in South African literature written by the black people, the literature of the oppressed. And this is, if anybody participates in the Time magazine, you can vote for the man of the century. Consider this guy. Who do you know in history that has wronged so much? And when he got in power, forgave everybody. Who's done that? I mean, the Americans didn't do it at Nuremberg. You know, we're going to get you. As far as I'm concerned, they deserve to be got. But Mandela doesn't have that attitude. It was during those long and lonely years that my hunger for the freedom of my own people became a hunger for the freedom of all people, white and black. I knew as well as I knew anything that the oppressor must be liberated just as surely as the oppressed. A man who takes away another man's freedom is a prisoner of hatred. He is locked behind the bars of prejudice and narrow-mindedness. I am not truly free if I am taking away someone else's freedom, just as surely as I am not free when my freedom is taken from me. The oppressed and the oppressor alike are robbed of their humanity. When I walked out of prison, that was my mission, to liberate the oppressed and the oppressor both. Some say that has now been achieved, but I know that that is not the case. The truth is that we are not yet free. We have merely achieved the freedom to be free, the right not to be oppressed. We have not taken the final step of our journey, but the first step on a longer and even more difficult road. For to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. The true test of our devotion to freedom is just beginning. I have walked that long road to freedom. I have tried not to falter. He was in prison, as you know, for 27 years. I have made missteps along the way, but I have discovered the secret that after climbing a great hill, one only finds that there are many more hills to climb. I have taken a moment here to rest, to steal a view of the glorious vista that surrounds me, to look back on the distance I have come. But I can rest only for a moment. For with freedom comes responsibilities, and I dare not linger, for my long walk is not yet ended. We're talking about heroes, and we're talking about the process of picking our heroes and of seeing what they represent of the stuff that we think is good in life or in sports, and the stuff that we don't think is good. And sorry, Dennis Rodman, but you can't be my hero. I don't care how many rebounds you get or how many times you help the Bulls win. Well, maybe he could if he don't. You can fire away after listening to this wonderful Swedish writer. There are good Swedish writers out there. Parlagerfist. His great novel, most famous, is Barabbas, and that and all his other work, but that was kind of the culminating one, not the end one, but the culminating one for his receiving the Nobel Prize. But in a very strange book, go read Barabbas, don't read The Eternal Smile, but it's full of great philosophy and theology. In The Eternal Smile, the plot is this. Everybody, it takes place in heaven, and everybody, of course, is dead. And dead from the life on earth, and in the way he depicts heaven, everybody is dead. All they do there is sit in the darkness for millions and millions of years. And he draws this great scene, well, I'll skip that. And they start talking with themselves, among themselves, and each tells this story, or her story, and their stories, one man's story is, well, I handed toilet paper under the door to people that needed it. And another person tells, well, I was the savior of the world. And another said, and I was the president of a country. And we have all this discrepancy among the positions of life. But each person asks the question, no matter whether they were the president or the toilet paper hander-upper, they said, what did it mean? What did life mean? And they get so agitated that they say, we have to find God and ask him. So they gather all the people that have ever died, get up and start walking, and it's an incredible scene and incredible imagery as they walk toward God in the darkness, and millions of people add, and millions more, and finally there are billions of people, and they finally come upon God, and he's depicted in this piece of fiction as an old man sawing wood, and there's a lantern beside him, and he's the only light in this whole darkness. And God said, they said, what's the meaning of life? What's going on? And God's answer, remember, this is an adjective, and this is, but it's Lagerfist theology, and you'll see it's not un-Lutheran. God rubs his gnarled, gray, hard-working hands through his hair and said, I just did the best I could. And I only intended that you need not be content with nothing. And of course, it puts all the responsibility for what life is on us. You know, you people, I intended that you need not be content with nothing. Well, they walk away and they say this. This is in my introduction to every athlete I coach. And we have a paper that comes out and we look at it and we talk about, you know, what you're into now that you're at Augustana. And this quote is in that. They walk away satisfied. Satisfied that their life had meaning. Satisfied that there was meaning in the community of life, no matter what your job was. And one man says, the wealth of life is boundless. And I'm equating this, obviously I give this to my athletes, to sports. And how the wealth of life is boundless. The wealth of life is as great as we can grasp. Can we ask for more? When, nevertheless, we do ask for more, then all the incomprehensible exists as well, all that we cannot grasp. As soon as we are able to reach out our hands for something, as soon as we get the feeling that something is, immediately it is. Can we ask for more? The sports analogy is, can I run this fast when I've never run that fast before? And then the athlete has to make the decision. The analogy in life is, all the incomprehensible exists as well. The first slave that ever thought of escaping, who was the first slave, I can guarantee you, had to ask the question, can the incomprehensible exist as well? No wonder so many slaves tried to escape. We don't hear about that in history, but talk to me, I'll tell you. Can all the incomprehensible exist in, the newspaper that we get here, it says, L.A. might lose its water battle. With a little tiny town up in the desert that LA's been sucking the water out of them since 1932, and they might now have to give it back. Can the incomprehensible exist as well? You get the connection. And that, as a coach, I would argue, and it comes from the awareness of this comes from the literature that we read, as a coach that I would argue that the athlete learns to reach for the incomprehensible. I can't run that fast. I'll just throw out a little word to you. I don't let athletes say that to me. Coach, I can't go out in five flat. five flat 5 minutes for the mile in the 5 mile race. I said, wait a minute, you can't say that. You can say I've never done that, but you can't say I can't do it. And so this last season, the senior came up and said, you say, coach, you're saying to go out in 5:05. I can't do it. I mean, I've never done that. Fire away. We've got, we're negative 1 minute. Sports is life, huh? But anybody, feel free to.
How do you respond to Barclay's comment about, I don't want to be your children's role model, you should be your children's role models? How do you respond to that? I mean, I agree with it.
Yeah, I do too. But he can't top out on his response. No, he can't escape that. No.
There seems to be a difference between sports, high school, college, and the kind of place you're doing, professional. And there it seems to be, you know, you own a team like the baseball team in Florida,
yeah.
And the next season you don't have anybody back.
You know what? You just raised an issue, since we're short of time, that Thursday night after Vespers, there's a forum on sports in our culture. And that'll be interesting. And a forum simply means we get to engage in discussion. And we'll have all kinds of opinions, and we can discuss just that. Why is it that, you know, what's up here in the professionals, and how is that filtered down to the sixth grade,
yeah.
Or hasn't it? Or, and how are they different? And you can discuss whatever you want to. But the stuff that's here is really what we pay closest attention to as participants in our sport.
I like the phrase you just used, that the professionals' attitudes, et cetera, are sifting down into the university level is very bothersome.
Oh, yeah. In the high school level. Anybody else? Well, yes. You can go whatever you want.
I've always wondered, what's the meaning if you don't affiliate with sports? But I often wonder if it's just sort of women who grew up, and I think I just missed the team sports thing. And I've never had this strong affiliation with sports teams that's so dominant in our culture. And what's good about that affiliation and what's bad about it? And you see it just go to such irrational extremes sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of something that divides us as people. People do affiliate with people they don't know, they had no connection with,
yeah.
And people who don't.
Yeah.
And what's the psychology of that? It's the way people experience community, I think, or don't.
Yeah, your answer can be that all that you've already talked about today is that you missed some of the good, but you experienced it other places. I mean, everything that we have up here, you can experience playing the piano.
Yeah.
But those things up there are if you participate, not spectate.
Well, Ann just left. We heard a story last night from her that she experienced all that as a fan. They were so intensely involved. But it is a little different. There's no doubt that fans are different than the participants. Fans don't take the risk.
It's vicarious.
Yes?
I think one thing that happened to me is my son, when he was playing ball in college, and I think he learned that already.
Yeah.
Playing all the sports, you know, the t-balls and the baseballs and the hockey and all that stuff was that when the bell was over, when at the end of the game, the score was on the thing. That was it. And with that Mandela thing, you know, when he was let out of prison.
Great connection. Nice going.
Was another new start.
Yeah.
And I can remember when my boy, you know, they were playing for the next one was national title, at St. John's.
Mm-hmm.
and an hour later, that whole team was down there coaching or getting the basketball team going.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, I was still crying in the stands.
That's my favorite phrase to kids when they get beat. Guess what? I still love you. The sun's going to come up, and you're okay. And pretty soon they stop getting beat as often. Because they get the freedom. Here's a favorite line of ours, too. You have the freedom to fail. And that's not just in sports, but most of us don't give ourselves the freedom to fail. And when we do, we beat ourselves up for not writing the letter at the right time or not. You know, I wasn't there when she needed. You know, we beat ourselves up. Well, they come to the forum, and I don't know how that's going to. I know it'll be good because the one person taking care of is right back there, one of the people. But come, Joyce Porter.